Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, Matthew here. Before we get started, I just wanted to plug another podcast I've been working on with Drawing Matter and the Architecture Foundation. It's called Power and Public Space, and it features short conversations with architects, artists, and academics that offer new possibilities for understanding and making public spaces today. Just search for Power and Public Space wherever you're listening to this now, and I hope you like it. Okay, now onto the show.
This way.
Okay, so let's see now if it works well.
I'm Matthew Blunderfield, and you're listening to Scaffold.
It's okay.
Okay.
So. In this episode, I speak with the architects Ricardo Flores and Eva Pratt.
And we have to try to not to overlap. It's not talking always, and the other one would be very difficult.
They founded their practice Flores and Pratt's in Barcelona in 1998.
It's radio.
Although it's really following the completion of the Sala Beckett project in 2016 that they became internationally recognizable. Sala Beckett is this incredible conversion of a former workers' co-op in Barcelona into a new drama center, retaining, adapting, and adjusting much of the existing building in ways that are surprising and even surreal. Doors, windows, and stairs change colors as they migrate from one place to another, and layers of old colors, patterns, and materials merge seamlessly with new interventions so that the building becomes this kind of vortex of past and present with its own lush and decorative language. A word that jumps out to me when trying to describe Flores and Pratt's work is analog. Many of their published drawings are done by hand, and in this kind of beautiful, almost antique way with stylized handwritten titles and layers of sketches often built up on a single sheet. It was so funny to me that after our conversation, as Ricardo and Eva were getting ready to leave for a dinner, they pulled out a physical map of London, hunched over it together, and ran their fingers along streets to find their destination. Further proof that these architects are really analog to the core. I spoke with Ricardo and Eva in London back in June of 2022 at One Old Street Yard. I was lucky to catch them while they were in town to install their work at the Royal Academy Summer Show, which, by the way, runs until the 21st of August. In our conversation, we focus on the Sala Beckett, as well as the social housing project Building 111, also in Barcelona, to tease out the themes and motivations that drive Flores and Pratt's work. All right, so here's the interview. I hope you enjoy it. I mean, I've never been to the Sala Beckett project. I've only encountered it through images when it was first completed, and then more recently through this book that we have here, just on the Sala Beckett, which is a series of essays and accompanying images and architectural drawings. And I mean, I read through the whole thing and I had this surreal experience that I was dreaming the whole time I was reading it. And it was quite... because I kept passing through these different phases of the building or different incarnations of the building simultaneously. So the first is obviously the building as a historical artifact, as this co-op, you know, that had the grocery store on the ground floor and where the pool halls, and there was actually a pool as well, and then a communal space on the upper floor. And then we have the dereliction of the building, that 30-year period you're describing, where the elements crept in and the whole thing was left to decay. And then we have the concurrent incarnation of the building where you start to see these layers of past and present correspond with each other to produce what is this new theater. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, even though my encounter of the project was only really through this book, it felt incredibly immersive. Mm-hmm. And maybe part of that is because of how scrupulously rendered the whole thing is. People might not appreciate actually just how much detail and energy has gone into representing, first of all, what was there. Everything from the doors to the windows, mm-hmm. to the door handles, mm-hmm. to the floor tiles and the patterns on the floor tiles. Everything is immaculately reproduced in architectural drawings by yourselves and your colleagues. And when I saw that, I was shocked.
Why?
I think I was shocked, first of all, by the effort, the sheer labor that I had imagined would be involved in producing a kind of index of parts of a building like this. But then I think I was shocked and surprised by how close, as architects, we can actually get to an existing building in a way that starts to bestow value on it. I wondered if you could tell me a little more about this process of analysis you undertook through drawing the existing building.
Well, because because we found it in this ruined moment, you know, that we thought that we could lose it. So we thought, okay, let's try to identify everything that has a value there. Also because in the local history of Barcelona, the Barcelona expand when the walls can be torn down, because it's a very closed city, super dense inside the walls. When they had the permission, the citizens, to turn down the walls, it expanded in 50 years immensely. The grid grew super quickly because the city really wanted to. And there was a lot of industry going on in textiles. So there was this capacity to absorb new people. So what happens is that in 60 years that the grid gets built, a big portion of it, with the similar materials, using in the floors and the kind of doors, massive doors, but done by carpenters who knew about geometry, who knew about making some little drawing in the doors. So there was a good culture in all this craftsmanship. But it's so common in Barcelona that even today, in renovation of apartments or old houses, all these things get thrown away. And you find these value elements in the street. And you see them. And sometimes we take pictures of it. We have a collection of it. We don't know what we will do with it. But so that was probably the first reaction. So this is a great material. We don't want to lose it. We know builders are not usually interested in this. So we dedicate this inventory that was like 100 A1 documents of one door with all its detail, with the moulture that makes the joint between the wood and the plaster, not to see the everything, for him to understand, for the builder to understand that he had to take out these elements carefully. Because the new distribution, the occupancy by the theater people was going to be different, was going to change the circulation. So we inventory all the windows, doors, tiles, decoration elements, everything. And we handle this to the builder, the first meeting we had with him. We told him, look, this is a treasure. And we knew that it was not going to be understood easily, because this is material that it's still kind of forgotten, not appreciated. But I think it's because it's so common. I mean, it's so rich, the city, in a way.
It's an embarrassment of riches.
Materials. It's like you don't see it, no? Kind of water hole.
But also, I think one thing you mentioned, the the meticulous way of drawing collecting all this information was crucial also to learn to get close to this construction or this building culture that we were inheriting, the ways of drawing the patterns in the tiles, the way they were turning the corner, you know, the tiles, they were like carpets in the room, so you always have a band at the end, an edge band in a neutral color to adjust this carpet with the room, with the doors. And then besides this neutral band, there was a kind of a perimetral band of the carpet, like a real carpet with another. So all this delicacy, but done in an industrial way, because as Eva said, it was a moment where the city expanded very fast. So it was an industrial construction, but it were very delicate patterns, and the way the doors were done and the ceilings with the roses, etc. It was a very valuable culture, but then if you get close to it and you learn how it was done and how they would the sizes of the windows, the partitions, the lattice, and all that. Then you could use them again. And if you had to modify them, you had the scale of the things. For us, it's very important, as you know, as an architect, it's very important to get into the scale of the things when you are doing reuse. The scale of a building, the scale of a urban piece, the scale of a house, the scale of a room, the scale of the lattice, everything is a question of scale and proportion. So when you touch it, if you have to modify, you adapt or extend or do a new piece nearby, how are you going to deal with it? How are you going to connect with that piece? If you have drawn very carefully before what exists, then your hand has already the scale. Doesn't mean that you will reproduce, but you can work in proportions that will not stand out from the existing. No? So
when you talk about understanding these historic traditions, it also reminds me of this historic figure who has come up, I think, in conversations around your work, who I think you've mentioned as well, Josep Maria Jujol, which is a person who, I mean, he was an employee of
Gaudi,
yeah, and a protege of Gaudi's as well, but lesser known, I think, historically. And yet, his process or his affection for, in a way, spolia or overlooked artifacts or architectural building materials and the reuse of these materials seems to speak quite directly to the kind of work you do. And I just wondered if you could tell me more about Jujol and his significance to the way you think about architecture.
Well, for us, I mean, Jujol is this person that teaches you how everything you find can be useful again and can be reused, even if even if it was used before many times, then it has the value of the use. Sometimes it doesn't have the economical value, but it has the value of the history of people have been touching it and using it before. When you bring these things with you to the time now, you are bringing this history with it. So the materials bring the history and the time with themselves. So reusing things for him was also bringing all the history to the actual time and adding not to the new program. This is the way he uses everything, and he has this capacity, but also the capacity of articulating things so that you don't see them individually again. You see them in the head of the new designer, which is now today. And this is very important because in a way for us to use ruin or to use a disused building, in a way you need to touch it and to respect it, but then bring it to an actual moment to add the new use, a new program, which might sometimes need some transformation. Sometimes you need an entrance of light to make it revive again or react again, or etc. So in that sense, it's acting with the things that you find
with the right to transform it.
No? With the right to inherit it and you.
To make sure that it will be in a way inherit and Salavegget people will take care of it. You have to adjust it to them. Mm-hmm. And then, so you have to modify the building a lot. Mm-hmm. It's true that Jujol was able to work with iron and paint walls. So he was really sometimes involved directly in painting the walls of some of his buildings or turning some iron pieces with a Smithman. So he was really working directly without this distance. He was very close to the construction. And his pieces are very poetic, also because they are so discarded things. They say, not things that you will retire. And also, he worked a lot on the land of Tarragona, on the landfill, close to the peasants. So on the land culture, reuse is completely embedded. Things, they always have another use.
When you say land culture, do you mean?
With peasants. He worked with people who cultivated the land.
Oh, okay.
He worked for them to build some churches or houses. So even they were giving him some of their tools, and he will make lamps or a fence with them. But it was very much in the tradition, because sometimes in the countryside, when a real house from a land worker, you find mattress being the fences for the chicken, these kind of things. So this kind of things is what Jujol was very interested in, and his work is very much connected with this radical reuse that happens in country houses.
It's interesting that you started really practicing in this moment of economic downturn. I mean, you established actually in the late 90s,
yes.
But these kinds of projects, Salad Bucket, are reflective of an economy in a certain amount of distress. I mean, certainly the budget was cut from, what, 8 million to 2.5?
Yeah.
Yes.
Or even lower, then it climbed back up. Mm-hmm. When you talk about making do or this kind of influence of the peasant attitude on the kind of architecture you produced, especially with Salo Beckett, there's still a real sense of decadence in the visual display and the kind of ornamentation and color and form. It's all there and it's all like fireworks. Mm-hmm. But it's in a way, I don't know if cheap is the right word, but it's certainly done without significant expense.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, we had a very, very restricted budget to make all these 3,000 square meters. And with this, you know, there is not apparent in the final result, but there's a lot of structural reinforcement to the building and acoustic reinforcements and things that consume a lot of money. So when you, at the end, what you have for the what is visible is very low. At the same time, one thing that we were always admiring of Jujol is how the walls he creates are never expressing the effort of the technical effort which is behind. Mm-hmm. So when you visit those places, it's always a kind of a dream or a place that has this delicacy and this beauty, very, very fragile beauty of very simple things that are held together. Mm-hmm. And you never see the enormous effort which is behind, the technical effort. And then we thought at Sala Beckett, at the cooperative building we inherited, if something was really precious there or beautiful there, was this ruin on this time accumulated, which is so fragile and easy to eliminate. And so we thought if we make evident all the installations of tubes or all the technical things for the theater, etc., we will lose all that. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, Jujol was an inspiration in the sense the experience of the experience in the building should be something that in a way makes you look at the walls and being able that you project your own memories on it. You project your childhood or your memories in when you see a tile, a window, or this kind of glass, or this kind of painting, etc. Each one has a personal experience because you will remember something from your grandmother's house, and I will remember something from another place, and etc. So each one visiting the place is having this kind of. So all these other techniques that have been happening there should disappear, and this in this sense, Jujol is so such incredible master because you never see what happened to make this kind of heaven happening there.
It's so interesting. Usually when we talk about adaptive reuse, we talk about efficiency, we talk about energy and embodied carbon, we talk about all the metrics, the measurable data that can support the decision to keep a building. And I'm conscious that rhetoric and reality of measuring a building's performance in that way is totally absent from the way you talk about reuse, which is on a much more intuitive, emotional, and expressive level. I mean, is that a conscious turn away from the more kind of positivist, scientifically framed argument for adaptive reuse, or is it simply you're just not interested?
It. No, it's the way I think it's not so long ago, no? I think in the time of our grandparents, reuse was the way of the economy. No? It's lately that we have lost this the importance, no, of keeping the watch from your father, all these kind of things that was very much in the culture of I remember my grandparents. very people of a lot of reuse of paper, and then going to the market with a wrap of that has a pattern of a square that is very typical in Catalonia. That you go to the market with it, not using plastic bags, this kind of, so kind of the Japanese wrapping thing. So beautiful things that have been lost. So it's not so far away. So we all have this, Ricardo and I have been living in the countryside for a while. So it's not, it's something that kind of came, it was in our natural, it was in our culture, family culture, but also with the clients. When we are, when we get the commission of Sala Beckett, we have gone through other clients that have opened our eyes to the existing buildings, in the way they explain us how they wanted to use it, that they make no difference between new and old, whatever. It was like, here, this is an office, we will reuse it, we have enough space for storage here, whatever. And they didn't want to throw things away. So people that already had this culture, and also some artists that also show us how to look at the ruins that's already there, being ready for occupation. So people that had helped us also to have this culture that was not so far away from us, but that during studies with, of architecture was not present. All the exercises were new buildings. But finally, you are out in the street, and the majority, you know, 90% of our work is reused. And we have found very creative people in textile business or artists that have opened our eyes into how to reoccupy the building, because they have such a familiarity with it. That's kind of, so it's what Ricardo was saying. There is a moment that you have to know the building, because they know it, but you don't know it. So drawing it, it's a very good way of... That you, Ricardo explained it very quickly, very not very clear. I think when you said have to draw the building to make it ours. No? When we start, one of our first works was on a windmill in Mallorca. I said we have to draw it, and it looks, we have, it's ours. You own it already, and then you start transforming it. And when you know it, it seems like you are, you get this little by little, this right or this confidence. So, okay, let's open one door here. Let's close the other one. Let's make them use this great space that they have it here, because it was hidden or latent there, but not really expressed. So how to make the building, how we understand the beauty of it to make it much more appear. And in this sense, is when natural light has makes this beauty appear. So a lot of our reused buildings have a very special light, natural light openings.
Yeah, I think also what we were asking in is, I think the adaptive reuse, when we talk about, we are much more interested in collecting all this invisible store, this heritage, which is, has more to do with emotional heritage, the social imprint that it, this building had in the place, etc. And of course, all these other technical aspects that you mentioned are there, but for us it's much more difficult to collect and bring to the actual condition all these memories, these stories, all these invisible, you know, nets that have happened there, that for us is how to enrich the new use of the place. All these other technical things, yeah, you give them for granted, you have to act on them. But for us, it's much more challenging, and the much more moving thing, for us, is how to collect all these other stories, no?
Yeah, these numbers.
The social condition of the building, no?
There's such a kind of direct relationship to the program of the theater here when we talk about stories and storytelling and imagination. And I think when I said I felt like I was dreaming when I was reading this book, that state of mind is so conducive to being a spectator. And there's this insight that I think the director of the theater, Tony Caceres, shared about how the audience is primed to receive the theater when they walk into the building, because there's evidence everywhere of past lives or past occasions or past moments that have played out that require a lot of imagination to complete. And yet, there's a sense of joy and intrigue and curiosity there that maybe would be less the case with a brand new building altogether.
Right.
For sure. Yep. Also, it's the theater people, but also was the former cooperativists that still live in the area. That when the Sala Beckett opened, they get into the new bar that now is in the street angle. Before it was in the first level, now it's in the street level, in the angle, in the corner of the building. And they get there and they start playing cards, Scrabble. They were like the first day opening of the bar. Mm. It was like they were thinking, oh, finally, you reopen. Uh-huh. It was their place. Uh-huh. And it was so good, suddenly. So they had a lot of memories. And they came back and it was their place. Then suddenly also there were theater people around, but everyone is at home. And it was very nice to work with this social anchor that the building had. Mm-hmm. This was so important. And Tony Casares knew it, and for us it's completely new. The emotional links with the building, for us, is the most important. It's what,
and also, it's a building with no, you know, it's no pretentious in the sense of no, it's welcoming everyone. And in that sense, is whatever says is very clear, because everyone feels, even if you are from the theater world, or from you're a neighbor, you don't know nothing about theater, you're not interested in theater, but you like the omelette that is in that bar, which is very good. You enter to the bar and you're there. So everyone feels. But one interesting thing that also happens with the ruins, or with the, you know, with the state of the building when it's open, let's say this unfinished condition of the ruin, allows everyone to feel at home, because the ruin has this kind of capacity of engaging with you. You easily feel like you remember something in your past, and that's was a way that everyone, students and playwrights and public, etc., feel they go there and they think that the building was like that before. And the building was not, I mean, it was, everything happened there, we put it upside down, everything, etc. But because the condition of the walls and many things and everything was reused and is still there, people feel like they was like that, and they feel at home, and they go. And that's very good for us, that the architect is not present in the touching of the thing, but the building looks like if it was always there like that. And for that, you need an enormous effort to make it happen, like if nothing had happened there.
I just need to, at this point, acknowledge this insane video you made called, is it 44 Doors and Windows?
Yes.
I think everyone who's listening needs to watch this video if they haven't already, because it's describing the, first of all, the kind of inventory of these doors and windows in the existing building, and then their migration into the new proposal, and this kind of almost like Busby Berkeley style theatrical performance or a choreography. Mm-hmm. As they all kind of march on to their new locations. So there's this really subtle but incredibly labor-intensive recomposing of the building using a lot of its existing components. Mm-hmm. I mean, I could follow that tangent, but I think what's more interesting at this point is to talk about the ways in which the theater itself is kind of infused throughout the building and all of its public spaces as well. Mm-hmm. There's this idea that you explained in a drawing, an axis of the building that you called theater everywhere in the building.
Yeah.
But I think the way I want to arrive at that kind of drawing is through an experience that you both had attending another theater. This was in Paris.
And
Théâtre des Boeufs du Nord?
Yeah. No.
Yes, right here.
It's Peter Brook's theater.
Yes. And so when I found out about this, I had this uncanny sensation, because I'd interviewed another architect recently, Carla Yasaba, who herself, I think, is doing research on Peter Brook and is equally captivated by him and his work. Mm. And I want to learn more about this director and why he's been so influential to architects like yourselves. I know that in the intermission of this play that you saw, you actually measured the theater that he had a hand in designing.
The seats, and that we were interested, because the audience and the actors are very close. They took out, in Le Bouffe du Nord, they took out the stage that might have been one meter higher than the floor, of the seats on the floor. So the actors and the public is in the same, sharing the same floor. Mm. And then, we wanted to measure it. Also because he reused an existing theater from the 18th century, and that was going to be demolished. And we thought it was a kind of similar, like when we were reading the book. It's a book, this book is not by Peter Brook, it's by Andrew Todd and the sonographer.
Jean-Guy Lecat.
It's called the Open Circle.
And it's beautiful. And they explain this place that they found for Peter Brook, and Jean-Guy Lecat was working with him, adapting the theater, and it's a beautiful adaptation that he made. And through him, we could stay in the theater between one play and the other and measure. It was such a place. It was beautiful. And the theater, there was a play by Peter Brook called The Suit, and the actors were. It was really beautiful. The whole thing, no? The theater. But then when the play stops, people stay in the theater a lot. They don't disappear.
In the place where the actor have been, you know. Because
the audience,
because it's like a
nice.
Yeah, it's like a, you know, you have the seats there and you have the stage, which is a floor extending over there in front of you. So when the actors disappear, everyone stands up and they start to talk and they look around and even they go, because it's a very intimate room.
It's not black, it's the red and some colors of the old colors. So also this was an interesting issue. And I remember when we phone, because it was a common friend, so we call Jean-Guy Lecat on the phone and he answered. I said, but who are you? So one of these architects that paints everything in black. And I said, no, we have not painted anything yet.
We're just starting
and we think this theater in Paris will be great for us to visit.
Yeah, it's interesting because one of the things that this Peter Brook theater teaches you is that the experience of going to the theater is like being together. It's a community, being in community, seeing the play together, laughing together, crying together, and being in a room with the actors and yourselves in a community, and the room is the building itself. Doesn't need to disappear in black. It's the room with the colors, with the original colors, and everyone has the abstraction to see the actors. You don't need to paint it in black to abstract yourself and see the scene. So returning to your comment on the drawing explains that the salas in Sala Beckett, the two theaters and the spaces, common spaces, are the same. Is the same experience. Going to the theater is not getting into a room that then you suddenly forget about the world. Going to the theater is meeting your friend in the ticket box, in the sofa, going to the bar, have a beer or a coffee, and waiting anxious to start, and then you get into the room, you meet the actors, and everything is a continuity. Mm-hmm. When we say the theater all around, is because we think that all the whole building, the theater have exploded and have occupied all the building, all of it, not just the two theater spaces, but all the vestibule, the staircases, the bar, etc. All is theater, all is an opportunity to meet and to experience that. And so we thought that the whole common spaces should give this opportunity of meeting, of eye contact, and meeting someone and all that.
And even the nice thing of Sala Beckett is that there is this bar, that also Le Bouffe du Nord has a bar, very small bar,
cafe.
And then the actors, they appear later, no? And they are full of energy after the play, and things have been good. So you can talk with them, and they react. They are happy. Usually, they are very happy to interact.
So there's no hierarchy or no kind of a distance between the actors and the public, and so it's not. You don't feel overwhelmed. But it's a place that is really waiting for everyone as individuals. No, you can be there alone or in group, and you feel really like a home of the playwrights.
There's this beautiful short film that you made. It's a stop motion film that speculates about the experience of different kinds of spectators in the building, whether it's a member of the public, whether it's an actor or a stagehand, or an office worker. And there's a kind of restlessness and glee.
Glee,
just a total delight, almost like a childlike delight. It reminds me a bit of the films of...
Wes Anderson.
Yeah, it reminds me a bit of the films of Wes Anderson. But also... maybe almost kind of cartoon or a children's program or something, that there's a naivete there, that again, the theater director himself, Tony Caceres, has pointed out where he's described you yourselves as children who know how to play. Children who are about to make a theater. And I just want to understand where this method of representing your projects through film first took hold, how that became a way of summarizing in retrospect the projects that you've done, because you've done this for a number of built projects of yours.
Yeah, I think
it all started in a very in a very simple way. I think I remember once we both. It all started when we thought about how to organize our web page, and it was a trip to Sydney, and we arrived there and we had like 2 weeks to work with very young students, and they didn't know who we were, and they were very, they were trusting us, and okay, let's draw the municipality, and you have to find a place, okay. But so they asked us if we had a web page, and we didn't have it. We never thought about having a web page. So when we came back, and we thought, okay, let's think about it and how we can do a web page. Architecture, you have to visit it because it is the space, the proportions, it's something that you have to walk through, and you can have an idea about pictures. But what we can explain to these Sydney students is how we work, how is our working space. So let's organize like a visit to the studio. That what happens when someone visits our studio, that we go through the rooms, and in the rooms are pieces of models or a drawing, and you start explaining, yeah, this is a textile factory, we enlarge, blah, blah, blah. And from one project, you go to another one, and it's very, and then you move through the corridor, let's show the view of the old town that we can see from our terrace. All these things will happen on the web page. And it happens to be that the students from UK sent us his curriculum, and he had a stop motion in it. And we thought, that is beautiful. And it was done very skilled, very nicely. So he came, he stayed with us for 9 months, and we proposed him, what do you think if we make the web page, and then we explain you what the project is about, and you make a film of it, and then you animate the different drawings and models and documents, because we work in a very physical way. We work a lot by hand, we produce a lot of models, so a lot of this stuff is on the walls or on the drawers. So it was like looking at it and putting active the archive. And Johnny Pugh, that this week has been in Barcelona with us, also filming the project that we are working at the moment. In Brussels, by the case, happens to be in the Royal Academy exhibition. So he has been with us.
But one interesting thing.
I moved through different. Ricardo will explain interesting, again.
You explain perfectly. No, the only thing I wanted to add is that the stop motion technique helped in this case very well to. Because you mentioned something, I think is crucial, which is the narrative of what you explain about the project. A real film would go, perhaps it would be much more difficult to mix all these different materials we work with, and which is a narrative. What do you want to explain about the project? Many times is a concept that is not linear or is not easy to film, but with all these other materials together, pieces of drawing, models, fragments of the construction site photos, the final condition photos, the original, etc. You make the trip that you want to explain someone, this kind of little narrative through mixing all these materials. So the stop motion helps that to do that. And then we started to build these kind of little stories of each of the projects.
I mean, speaking of storytelling and what I see of as a kind of documentary project as well, you also produce more standard films as opposed to stop motion, one of which is a documentary of one of your projects post-occupancy or in use. And this is the
Meeting of the Building one.
So the documentary is called Meeting of the Building.
Meeting at the Building.
Meeting at the Building. And it's about building 111.
It's a social housing project, yes.
In Barcelona.
In Barcelona.
And there's a real tenderness in the kind of gaze that the camera fixes on its subjects, in this case, the occupants of the building itself. And there's an interview with one woman in particular named Magda, which you highlight in some of your lectures. And Magda is, first of all, kind of talking about how she likes to decorate her apartment and paint the wall. And then she says that on the balcony she doesn't feel lonely. And then it comes out that her partner, her husband, left her the year before with her son.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, I mean, it sounds maybe kind of saccharine the way I'm describing it now. Mm-hmm. But in watching her recount her experience and the way that essentially the life of the courtyard gave her a new set of friendships and relationships, there's something incredibly moving about it.
Mm-hmm.
And you could almost sense in the way it was filmed as well that there's a real enthusiasm for witnessing these moments of deep social connection that in some way is fostered by the architecture itself. There's another great scene. First we see this teenager with his top off across the courtyard. And then the next moment we're in his apartment.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a bunch of teenage boys with their shirts off. I think they were just watching pornography or something. And then...
and someone said,
But then they turn on Call of Duty, I think, and start playing video games. And the camera is almost trembling with delight, again, at seeing the building in use. And I think that kind of enthusiasm for occupation is rarer than you might expect still.
Yeah, what happened in the 111 is 111 families living there, or houses. It's, it was a big challenge. It was the biggest project we did, and in fact, the biggest we did.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a big responsibility to make, because it's social housing means that you have people from different backgrounds, social background, religious, economical, etc., professional, from educational, and then you put them together to live together. So for us, was not just to do 111 houses, but how to make something else with all these houses, how to make a unity or community out of that. And this big patio that we proposed, which was not given in the program, was an unprogrammed part of the project. For us is a place where they will meet and they will say hello, or eventually they will make a meeting in the patio and talk about their problems, their joys, etc. Leave the kid because I have to work tomorrow, and especially could you keep my or go for the, you know, for the shopping, etc. Help each other. So all these kind of social relations that started to happen when you put them together and it starts to work on this kind of things that you think that could be a help, that you are giving a help to this housing, is working. We thought we wanted to register that because it was for us this kind of extra, this kind of invisible thing that you are, it is appearing among the users, mm-hmm. that you expected and you dreamed that it happened when you were drawing, but you never know if it will happen.
Mm-hmm.
So when Magda says, yeah, I don't feel alone, I had this very bad, you know, split with my partner, etc., I had very mad moments, and then suddenly she feels that she can rely on the neighbors, even if she doesn't need them, she knows that she can go into the balcony and say, hey, and then she can count on them.
Mm-hmm.
This is very powerful in a way, it's like really living in community.
And just for listeners who might not understand what we're talking about, the residents even have this term for the kind of chatter that goes on in the courtyard. They call it radio patio.
Yes.
The thing with we made a, because we were so concerned of what has happened with this courtyard, that it really works, uh-huh. and making these connections between them, and they get to know each other. So we organized a workshop. We were working in a master program of housing, and then we said, okay, why don't we go with the students, with the participants, already young architects, to this building, and then make some interviews and see after 1 year of living there if these connections has been working, how they relate, what they think of the apartments that we proposed. So we had like maybe 40 interviews or something, and then any kind of opinion. No, I mean, it was good for us to read it. And then, so this happened, and then we realized that there was some kind of community going on there, and people was kind of curious of meeting the others, and they were making some bingo, no, it's called
kind
some
of
parties,
a lottery,
lottery you, in the courtyard,
kind of a game
in summer nights. So they invite us to go there. Then we went there, and then it came the idea of making this film, and we call. For this case, we're not involved in the script and in the making. We just called some young filmmakers that we knew in Barcelona, younger than us, and then we went with them in one of these summer night
parties.
Mm-hmm. And we introduce them to the neighbors, and we propose the neighbors, do you mind if they come here for one day or one and a half day and mm-hmm. see what's going on in the car? Oh, yeah, you can come. When? Which day? Okay, let's think. And then they organize among them. And they propose, the filmmakers propose the script, mm-hmm. and they did it. Mm-hmm. And it was nice when we saw what they have decided. And
mm-hmm. yeah. I mean, it's a beautiful short film, and it puts me in mind of this book, I'm sure most listeners will be familiar with, and it's by Georges Perec, La Vie de Mode Emploi.
Yeah,
and I heard that this is one of your favorite books.
Well, it's one of our books, yes. It's impressive, really.
Somehow, when we listen to one afternoon of listening all the interviews that the students have been, the young architects have been collecting, it was delirious. So something like what in this book, you think, come on, what I'm reading. No, but it's so curiosity.
Right. This is so interesting because it kind of brings us back to this relationship you have with built matter, with material culture, with artifacts and things in general, where if we're looking again at Salah Beckett, to most people, the objects in the building, the surfaces of the building, the fixtures of the building would be deemed ordinary and worthless. Mm-hmm. And to you, through this kind of intense scrutiny and representation through these very detailed drawings, this close looking at these things, they take on a profound expressive potential. But it's that same sensation I had when I see the scrutiny with which you bring to the narratives of this housing complex, the individuals in them. Whereas again, it could feel like radio, it could feel like background and kind of useless information. But in a way, the closer you look, the more important it becomes, the more critical it becomes, the more value it takes on. And you mentioned that these kinds of films you produce, they are a kind of drawing. They are an act of drawing in a way. Mm. And it looks like in the teaching that you've done more recently, you encourage your students to work in this mode, thinking of filmmaking as a kind of architectural drawing. I wondered if you could talk more about that process of observation, which just to kind of frame it, you've referred to in various ways, but there's this term observational cartography, which has come up, mm-hmm. maybe in tangent to this filmmaking question.
Yeah, we give names to the different documents that we ask students. Usually, the courses we make, they develop, the whole team in the studio goes producing different kind of documents, and they kind of advance in the same. We want them to go through the different reflections in a similar rhythm, so that they can compare among them and really know what's going on in the other's one. Mm-hmm. So we draw by hand, so the public is very, the work is very public, it's on the table. So as you enter into the studio, you see everything. It's like a market, mm-hmm. You see, the best apples over there, or the very interesting strawberries. So these things, we really like the atmosphere of having 25 people, young people, drawing something, mm-hmm. and that everyone can participate. So observation cartography was the name of an exercise we did at the very beginning to know about the evolution of the site of the city that they are working on. And then during the process, we produce so many drawings or models and physical things that help us to move forward. And there is a moment that we thought to work with it, and we all ask Johnny Pugh, that it's now an architect, not the student that started our web, to help us in this moment. And so he gives the students some clues on how to make all the documents that have been producing, to make them explain some quality of the project. They think it's not fully expressed, so they can animate them with people, or they just show the evolution, but we ask them to make a concrete quality of the project, how they can explain it through the film. Mm-hmm. But we always think that when you want to explain something, sometimes it's a model that will explain it, sometimes it's a drawing, and sometimes it's a film. These films that we ask the student is like to ask them to reflect and to reuse the material that they have been doing, to rescue the drawings from the very beginning and go through them again by the end of the semester. Mm. And make them alive, or make them explain more clearly some quality, or even they discover something that was done more intuitively. But it's Yeah.
Also, is a way
going,
I think is
backwards
a,
now and reflect over your
I
work.
I think these films many times activate more or ask more. The document they ask them to be more, explain more things, because sometimes a drawing is a beautiful axonometrical drawing, etc. But then you can activate it more with you know, with putting people on it and making it move, and then you explain. You make it you use it more times, the same document, you know. Mm-hmm. It's not just a drawing, but now it's an animated drawing. It's something you activate it more. So how to activate all these drawings that you've been producing and models, putting them in a narrative that explains something else that the drawings by themselves alone are not able to explain of the building, of the project. Mm-hmm. So how to use them all, no, and combine them.
Yeah, and to come back to these documents, no, because we really think that architecture is also an exercise of resistance. Resistance, you say, no? Mm-hmm. I mean, you have to come back to your ideas, no? Then the ideas are in these documents and your proposal is in these drawings. You have to come back to them and try to look at them again, and you have to be critic with yourself. That's why, you know, clients and other collaborators helps you so much. So yeah, we think it's good for them to revisit the documentation before finishing the semester.
Because this film thing is right at the end, when they've been producing a whole semester of drawings and models and different kind of documents.
I want to talk more about, we're almost done, by the way. I know this is going on a bit long, but I want to talk more about this kind of internal resistance in a project, almost from a practical standpoint for a moment, because as we were discussing before, there is this incredibly labor-intensive process of documenting and representing the building that you're working with, in the case of Sala Beckett, an intense amount, I can imagine, of time and energy and just producing this elaborate inventory of parts, the building as you found it. I want to understand how you can actually do that as architects in a way that basically allows the business to stay afloat. Because we're talking about filmmaking, which is a kind of art, and I think there's so much artistry involved in the level of care and attention that the practice brings to this kind of work. And so, practically speaking, how do you do it?
I think sometimes the when we move through the projects, we try to keep our studio small. We try to dedicate to few projects in a time so that we can be effective with them. And for us, being effective means that we can give the time to research through them, to work with the client a lot, and sometimes to revisit them, because it's very important for us. Once it's built, what's the reaction? No? How it's accepted? What we will change, no, in a while, because it takes time to change your mind, but you are able to look back at the things and think, okay, maybe that. So I think this way that we kind of focus in a few projects at a time, we're able to manage to give the time to them to really enjoy them in a way. And I mean, it's not all joy, but I mean, to really get into it. I think we can make it work by keeping the office small and concentrated in a few projects.
But also, I think these other documents that you're talking about that are, for us, are a way of advancing the ideas. It's not just for joy or for that we make it, but it's a way of opening the fields of research that the projects can give you. So in a way, sometimes there are documents, of course, that you invent, nobody asked them for, but sometimes they could look like capricious or something that you, but then that documents are talking about the subject that you want to investigate, or is opening to a discussion or a dimension of the project that is very important and is not the program itself, but is feeding the culture of it. So every project has a culture that is completed by the drawings, the technical drawings, plus all the models that nobody asks you for, plus all the films and drawings and other things that are around you and help you to go forward. Because as Eva said before, it's very, some of these projects might take years and years. So how you keep on moving? What is really making you, giving you the joy of going ahead and going to the office and looking at the project with a new joyful, you know, eyes? And then many times these other documents are so important to make you go. So if you ask yourself economically how you do, yeah, well, we don't know, but they are as important as the practical drawings or the more, you know, construction drawings. All of them are making the are equally important for us. Everything is equally important: the inventory, the films, the construction drawings, everything. Is in your head, and it's kind of all this is feeding you all the time, and then that's why when you finish you cannot leave it so easily, and then you go back, and then you make the questions to the neighbors, and then you make a film eventually, because it's like it's for you, it's a story that continues. No, you cannot cut, and then it mix with a new project, and sometimes
There are a lot of things that we help it. It helps us a lot of communicating what we are doing.
And engaging other people.
And engaging. Because developing a project, you know, I mean, as architects, you develop a project that it's part of a bigger project that you are jumping in for a few years.
Mm-hmm.
So this connection with the people who is dealing this longer project, you know, being a collective housing project, a theater project, it's very important. And for this time that you are with them, you work with them a lot, you produce as an architect, but you can do to kind of to display all the information, to keep adding things into the project these 2 years that you are developing it.
But also it's true what you say, that there is a lot of material which in a way allow other people
to jump
from
into
other disciplines to participate, because you need, of course, the builders, with people which is not in your office, the client and the neighbors and etc.
Mm-hmm.
So many of these documents are engaging them in, and they show you, they show also that they are this kind of this joyful condition of the project, that and this enjoying the opportunity of doing things that has to be present, not this optimism. And the films, when they make you know the spirit high, and then again it's very positive, because everyone gets into the spirit again. It's not just numbers and product.
Making
for
a
us.
Building is such a, it's, you know, it's a risky, it's dangerous economically. I mean, there is so much risk involved.
Mm-hmm.
So at least I think you want to make sure that someone will take profit of it emotionally, not only economically. So is and it that it will work. So that these all these tests is because of this doubt: will it work? No, will they like? Are they really understanding what we are proposing? And so, and we work a lot of following some intuitive works. So sometimes when it's finished, then you realize, when you were talking about Sala Beckett, how much theater is in it. When after finishing it, we had this confusion: how much scenography, about architecture is, how because it's not temporary, but the Sala Beckett theater make us really aware of how much theater is in life and our life. It's very theatrical in a way.
I'm so tempted to end it there. It's such a beautiful way to end. But I have one itching question I feel like I need to ask you. And it's about this kind of liberation that I feel you have when I look at your drawings, where any given plan, if we're talking about Sala Beckett, has this kind of fluidity to it and improvised nature and freedom that you rarely see, I think, in an architectural plan, especially now for some reason. There's something kind of, there's a vintage to it almost, the kind of flexibility that you're still able to bring to a contemporary project, let alone an adaptive reuse one. And it reminds me so much of Enrique Marais and the kind of freedom that's so evident, formally speaking, and visually speaking, in a lot of the work that came out of his office. And I know you both work for Marias. And I mean, maybe this is a kind of tiring question, or in a way, a bit reductive to assume this kind of lineage. But I'd be interested to know what you brought from Marias into your own practice, what you learned from working there.
Yeah, well, I was a student then, a lot of years, 9 years during my career. So university in the morning, and in the afternoon working with Enrique and Karma, and then with Enrique alone. And I found it great the way that they, what really kind of attract me is the geometry they use, and the kind of clean drawings that they were making, that they were not making the walls in black, and so everything was lined, so it was more like a writing. But then you work there, and then you realize Enrique, even as a teacher, he was very pissed off if you mention a line. It was not, no, there's no lines, no. Where is the window? This is the door. So everything represents something. So you start being aware that you have the responsibility of building. And when you are doing these drawings, it's going to the construction site. And they were going to the construction site with this beautiful drawings that they were producing. And I liked the geometry. You know, I remember Carmen and Rick talking, and the way they were wanting the project to move forward, and the capacity of making things to articulate reality with the existing, this capacity, and the confidence that developing this geometry and drawing and redrawing things until they get kind of naturally one thing gets into another. I found this flexibility from the way of drawing was beautiful.
Flexibility of mind,
and then open project. You know, never the hurry for a solution.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. No, we were really impressed, and what we perhaps we brought with us is this challenging, or can you say this effort you make so that the build you force this, you have always, you learn that you have to force the reality to make things happen. You never give up in trying to incorporate what you think the project might have, and then you always have to negotiate and force economical problems, of course technical problems, programmatical problems, and then you are always there not to leave the project until you think really is full of all the joy and all the possibilities that it has. I was really always impressed in how Enrique in that office was always able to open a new book, even if it was in the last moment of the project or competition, a real one, to incorporate new things that he realized that could become part of the project and enrich it. So never close your mind, or never close the project until really, even until it's built, even, or you could, even in the construction site, we have this consciousness with Eva that we go to the construction site, and if we see things that can be better, we just say, and we, it's not that we don't care, but we know that things can be really challenged, the limits of the reality, to incorporate things if you think in new things that are improving them, negotiating whatever is necessary. So this never low down the level of exigence of your everyday life in the drawings or in the documents you make or in the construction. This is something that Enrique was perhaps the great master for us, no? And then you always remember this when you had these persons near you and seen in the everyday thousands of problems that you know how, but then how you face them with this optimism and capacity of thinking, I'm going to bring them over, and we will overcross them and bring them to a fantastic future. Then this is what, in a way, fills in your days. And you, if you think like that, and you think that you can do it well, and nothing can stop you, then in a way, then you try.
Ricardo and Eva, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Scaffold is an Architecture Foundation production. I'm Matthew Blunderfield, and I make the show. The theme music is composed and performed by Luke Blair. Subscribe to Scaffold on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, and follow the show on Twitter and Instagram at Scaffold_podcast. If you like the show, spread the word and leave a rating on iTunes while you're at it. Thanks to Flores and Prats. Thanks as always to Scandalin. And thanks to you for listening. I'll see you next time.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There's stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like worried of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.